Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Brief, a podcast that brings you context and perspective on global issues. We encourage you to follow us on YouTube at The Brief Pod or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. At this point, the war in Gaza has gone on longer and been more deadly for civilians than most of us feared. It leads us to wonder whether this conflict, with its terrible toll on children and worsening hunger, is being dragged out and why. The plight of more than 120 Israeli hostages seized by Hamas on October 7th, it's dragging out too. Despite withdrawing some troops, Israeli officials say a ground operation in the overcrowded town of Rafah near Egypt's border is still planned, risking what UN officials warn could be a humanitarian catastrophe. The high number of civilian casualties and tragic deaths of humanitarian aid workers triggered sharp criticism from Washington. On the surface, though, the relentless supply of arms underscores the U.S. support that has sustained Israeli military operations to date. To survey what is happening and share perspective on all of this, we're grateful to be joined by veteran Palestinian politician and activist and scholar, Dr. Hanan Ashrawi. Hanan Ashrawi, hello and welcome to The Brief Podcast.
Hello, Jim. Thank you. It's good to be with you.
You know, after working for an end to occupation, trying to promote peace in the Middle East for decades, is this just about the worst time that you can remember in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Absolutely. It certainly is the worst time, not just that I can remember, but that I can't remember that my parents told me about, in the sense that the Nakba of 1948, which was carried out to establish Israel on Palestinian land, where Israel carried out, or the terror groups in Israel carried out a series of massacres and destroyed whole villages in Palestine and expelled half the population, turned them into refugees. This was the horrific incident that shaped the collective trauma of Palestine at the establishment of Israel. And people now are finding parallels with the Nakba, in the sense that there are massacres and so on and expulsions. But in the collective memory, again, this is worse than even the Nakba, because it is a willful, deliberate, total genocide in all aspects. The destruction of human life, attempts at destroying the past, cultural centers and so on, and destroying the present. Homes, hospitals, institutions, museums, everything, and destroying the future in the sense that they are starving people to death. They are destroying universities and schools. They're killing people, carrying this out all in plain sight and just not getting any kind of accountability, but getting rewarded for it. And not only that, but major powers being complicit in it, like the U.S., for example, countries that are still sending weapons while seeing that there is a clear genocide taking place. And that's why I say every single Palestinian is traumatized. Every single Palestinian feels a deep, deep, deep sense of grief, of sorrow, of being personally involved and engaged in this horrific genocide and massacre of the innocents. It's totally, totally intolerable and unacceptable.
President Biden has said that, well, he's indicated he's diverging from whatever strategy it is that the Israelis are using. He's even said, I want to recognize a Palestinian state somewhere down the road. But the arms keep flowing, as you noted. I mean, has he lost all credit? Has the U.S. lost its credibility here?
The U.S. certainly has. We kept saying that earlier, that with the constant supply of weapons, with the funding of Israel, billions annually, with the special treatment and so on, and with the impunity it grants Israel, giving it full cover from any kind of accountability, that the U.S. has no credibility in the region and probably in the world. But now, given the realities on the ground, given the deliberate slaughter, the the carnage in Gaza, the total destruction in Gaza, the starving people to death, killing innocent children and women and so on. And the U.S. is being seen, I don't want to say the U.S., because frankly speaking, the American public has been on the move, has been active. We have seen massive demonstrations and statements and disruptions and people reaching out and writing and speaking out and protesting and asking for a ceasefire and so on. These are, to us, the American people. This administration has been the worst in the sense that it constantly supplies Israel with weapons. It constantly even circumvents American legislature in order to give weapons to Israel. It supports Israel blindly. It vetoes UN Security Council resolutions, with the exception of one. And then Biden turns around and says, you know, this is a humanitarian disaster. It has to stop. What? It can stop instantly. All you need to do is say no more weapons to Israel. Stop the carnage. Stop the genocide. You can do it instantly. I mean, it's an insult to our intelligence. And to say that we need to find different ways of sending food and medicine to the Palestinians in Gaza, when he allows Israel to continue the closure of the Rafah crossing point, and then tries to find different ways that are not effective and that are very demeaning and are not making a difference, like, you know, parachuting some parcels from the sky or trying to build a pier to Gaza. All you need to do is just tell Israel, open the crossing point, for heaven's sake. There are thousands of truckloads waiting to enter. And Israel is refusing to let them out. And not only that, but it has been deliberately targeting and killing aid workers and supply depots and places where there is food that is coming to Gaza. And not only that, but they have killed, they have targeted people who are rushing to try to get these food parcels. There are different ways of being killed in Gaza. And Israel is using all of them. Israel is using every means possible, including disease, of course, because there's no clean water. And then he comes with this hypocritical lip service, that it's a humanitarian disaster. We will recognize a Palestinian state down the road in due process in the future. So how come you have allowed Israel for decades to destroy the Palestinian state? To steal more land, build more settlements, which are war crimes, to unleash the settlers at the West Bank.
This is the point that struck me. I heard Senator Schumer stand up and say, well, Bibi Netanyahu has to go. I think everybody can agree he's been an impediment to peace, a full-scale blockade, if you will, over all the time that he's spent in office. But to say, well, I'll say that, and that's going to solve the problem. We get rid of one man. That's not the problem. Senator Schumer and others, U.S. lawmakers, European lawmakers, have really given impunity for all the violations of U.N. resolutions, the occupation, expanding settlements. They've given it impunity for decades. That is how we ended up here.
Exactly. Had Israel been held accountable at any point, from the beginning, from day one, when it carried out these massacres in historical Palestine, from day one, when it expelled half the Palestinian population, when it totally razed to the ground over 500 villages and towns in Palestine. This is ethnic cleansing, and they knew it was happening. But that started a whole trajectory where the Palestinians are rendered invisible, without power, and are dehumanized and demonized. And Israel is given a preferential treatment as a country above the law, as the U.S. special ally with qualitative military edge and so on, a strategic ally. This has enabled Israel and has given it a sense of entitlement and power and unbridled violence, where it thinks it can get away with everything, including massacres and death, literally. That's what it's doing. And now, you know, the chickens are coming home to roost. You have, in a sense, developed a monster in the region. But now the difference is that, unlike, you know, Biden, Blinken, Schumer, or whoever you want, the people are speaking out. And this is important because they are getting access access to facts, access to information, where the mainstream media is no longer the gatekeeper over the information, over the minds of people, where the manipulation of the public message and discourse is no longer at the hands of a few. So that's why...
Especially among younger people.
Yes. Younger people, people of intelligence, and people who have the drive, the need to know the truth and to act accordingly. People who don't want to act on the basis of handed down slogans and cliches, but who want to think for themselves. And this involves also many groups, minorities in the States, Black Lives Matter, Code Pink, even the Latin American community, many communities, other movements, LGBTQ, and so on. These are people who know what it means to be excluded and oppressed, and who know that the U.S. is carrying out this latest form of colonialism by aiding and abetting Israel as a colonial settler state, and aiding and abetting the genocide of Palestinians, which is happening clearly, as we said, in plain sight. So this will make a difference. Maybe the impact will not be felt immediately. Maybe Biden probably will lose, but in the long run, these people will become, the younger generations will become the decision makers.
But I want to go back to something that you mentioned, and that is, I remember there was a time when representatives of the foreign ministry, whether it was consulates, ambassadors, lobby groups, pro-Israeli lobby groups in the U.S., came out specifically and put pressure on the mainstream media to silence Hanan Ashrawi, to take her off the air. There was, I think, some were intimidated because of your intelligence, frankly. You were smarter than them, and you were making points.
Maybe. No, I've seen this firsthand. Yes, of course. There was a concerted effort. I remember they used to send instructions even to the pro-Israel lobby and to the mainstream media and so on. Or they would send them even talking points and tell them how to challenge me, and sometimes even how to attack me. And this was in public appearances and with the media. They would also protest, and they would say, why do you have Hanan Ashrawi? You shouldn't have her, and so on. Or sometimes they used another way of silencing me by saying, well, you need to have an Israeli. You cannot just have a Palestinian on the air. You need to have an Israeli with her. And then they would send messages to Israelis saying, don't appear with Hanan Ashrawi in the same program or on a debate. Don't debate her, you will lose. Which meant that they had censored me. And the CNN would come and say, I'm sorry, we cannot find an Israeli to appear with you, so we have to cancel you. And I said, listen, I said yes, and I agreed. It's not my problem that you're unable to find an Israeli to speak or to face me. This happened for a long time. I could see it. I could hear it. I could see some producers being reprimanded, whether in the States or here, even in Jerusalem and so on. Why did you have her on? They're afraid of the truth. It's not Hanan. What I represent in many ways is the willingness, I don't want to say the courage, of speaking the truth. You have to be truthful. You have to be honest. You cannot be intimidated. You have to have the courage to stand up to them and to expose all the lies. Israeli policy has been based on distortion, on fabrications, and on deception. You deceive the audiences, you create lies, you create false realities, and they become the basis of decision-making, and you feed those in a very well-oiled machine to mainstream media, and of course, to feed American policy as it stood. And there were, unfortunately, many people in the American official system that didn't want to hear Palestinian voices, not just Hanan. Palestinian voices who could challenge the stereotype, who could debunk the myths, who could expose the lies. These are things they didn't want to see or hear because the dominant version was so clearly, blindly pro-Israeli, anti-Palestinians, totally racist in terms of anti-Palestinian racism. And they wanted to suppress the Palestinian narrative and story. And so by challenging and defying and breaking not just stereotypes but limits, this was something that they didn't want to see. But now, fortunately, as I said, social media and other forms of access to the truth is making this kind of censorship, this kind of closure of the public domain much more difficult.
So, well, sadly, that doesn't extend everywhere. We have a record number, 78 Palestinian journalists killed in Gaza. And what is unprecedented, Fanon, really, is that many of them were wiped out with their families. And it struck fear, the journalists that were still there. And I think that goes as well to the message. Well, the record of history, if you will, from these journalists.
Exactly. 130 some journalists were killed, not just 70. So. And they were deliberately killed. Some of them shelled and bombed in their cars. Some of them in their homes, asleep with their families, with their children, and so on. So there was a deliberate targeting of journalists at Gaza, the same as there were deliberate targeting of academics, of students, of all sorts of institutions that could challenge the Israeli version. But these, in particular, these journalists and reporters, the Palestinian ones, are extremely courageous. Many of them got to the point where they wouldn't sleep at home because they didn't want to expose their families to being killed or shelled or bombed. Many of them also ended up sleeping out in the field because they didn't want to try to get places where others may be targeted or be collateral damage alongside them. So the dedication to their not just to their profession, to their people, to the truth, to the fact that they have this responsibility of bringing the truth out, of reporting the silenced voice, because Israel, as you know, did not allow foreign journalists to enter Gaza at all. Even Karim Khan of ICC came and visited Israel, but not Gaza, when the culprit is Israel, not Gaza. They wouldn't allow major guests, including the EU commissioner to enter, and so on, because they don't want the truth to come out, regardless from the source. Even people who are objective, professional, and so on were not allowed to enter. And then they manipulated the mainstream media. I have instances of reporters who knew that they were reporting falsehoods and lies, who knew, and who knew they were being fed these things by the Israeli military that became their only source, and who knew that some of these, if not all of these pictures that were fabricated and doctored and photoshopped and so on, were not real. And yet they kept seeing them, they kept reporting them, they kept repeating this misleading version, and they did not bother not just to check it, but to talk to anybody else. And you would stand immediately being accused and attacked if you challenged this Israeli version that was so professionally manufactured and handed to the mainstream media to regurgitate without thinking. This has undermined the integrity of the U.S. and its credibility as a whole, along with the official positions of the administration that have become absolutely ridiculous, where the spokespeople like Kirby become apologists for Israel, and they justify Israeli crimes, and Miller and all this, instead of saying this is a serious report by Francesca Albanese, he starts accusing her of being anti-Semitic, which is the favorite, of course, ploy used by Israel to silence people, accusing them of anti-Semitism because they're telling the truth. So he's repeating the racist tropes, challenging international or accusing and maligning international representatives of being anti-Semitic because they told the truth. So this has demeaned the standing and undermined the standing of American spokespeople as well as American officials and so on. Biden repeated the lies. Biden. Blinken also. I mean, Blinken came to Israel and said, I'm here as a Jew. I mean, who cares? Are you giving your credentials to Israel that now we are a tribe? What is this? You are a secretary of state of a major country. Huh? You should come in order to end this situation that is so lethal. Instead, you come to give your, to show your loyalty to Israel. Okay, you want to be Israeli, go and move to Israel. But you cannot claim to be secretary of state of a major power and gain your credentials and your standing as a Jewish member of the clan. But this is not acceptable. So that really undermined him.
And based on what some have said was extremely flimsy evidence of a handful of workers that may have had sympathies with Hamas, may have actually participated without proof in the attacks on October the 7th. But, you know, the U.S., others, immediately cut funding. And the U.S. was
Absolutely.
Giving about half of what UNRWA needs to operate. They are the only group that's in a position to really help distribute aid in Gaza right now. And they want to do away with them.
Yeah. Israel has been trying to destroy UNRWA for a long time. United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees. As you said, it was established particularly for Palestinian refugees in 1949. Israel was admitted to the UN conditionally, on condition that it allows for the return of the Palestinian refugees, and has not done so so far, and refuses to acknowledge the right of return, and at the same time has targeted UNRWA, which was actually proposed by the U.S. It's amazing. It's the U.S. who started UNRWA at the U.N. and voted for UNRWA at the U.N. in 1949. It began its work in 1950-51. So this is one way of eradicating and erasing the past. As Ilan Pappa says, it is a process of displacement and replacement. They want to eradicate our past, displace us, and replace us with other people. So if they acknowledge the presence of refugees, it means we were there. Now they're saying we're not there. It's one of the myths, you know. And they're saying that the ethnic and religious purity of Israel, is religious more than ethnic, is much more important than international law, human rights, Palestinian rights, whatever. So they want to have an exclusively Jewish state as an embodiment of the essence of Zionism, is that anybody who's non-Jewish has no rights. So this is one way of erasing our history, of manufacturing a different type of past and history, and at the same time of preventing any kind of rectification of a major historical injustice, which is turning half a population into refugees. And they thought if they got rid of UNRWA, they could get rid of that issue. And UNRWA exists until, as they said, they are returned to their homes, until the refugee issue is resolved. They don't want to solve the refugee issue. They don't want to accept the right of return, and they don't want UNRWA to stay. And now, given the horrific conditions in Gaza, UNRWA is so badly needed. It is the only organization that can carry out these services because it knows the place. It has the list. It has 13,000 workers in Gaza. It has 30,000 workers in Gaza, the West Bank, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. UNRWA is a massive organization that has been doing fantastic work, that has opened schools and hospitals and social welfare issues and so on. And it is a major source of stability in the region. And now they want to destabilize the whole region. They want to punish all Palestinians. They want to prevent, of course, aid from coming in, but they also want to prevent the major aid agency and distributor, and the only one that has the know-how and the knowledge and the experience. There are 13,000 in Gaza, for heaven's sake. They want to prevent them from working, and they want to defund UNRWA to the point where it's bankrupt. Now, the crime, we know Israel has been trying to do that for a long time. But what's criminal is that, as you said, this alleged accusation that there were 12, and they said no, 7 workers in UNRWA who either took part or were implicit or in the attack on October 7th. So you destroy a whole organization which provides state-like services to a whole population, and you don't stop to question, to verify Israeli Israel's policy has always been based on lies and fabrications. We all know that. You issue a lie, it becomes currency, the media repeat it, and then when it is demonstrated to be untrue, nobody has the patience, you know, to listen, because it has gained a life of its own, traction. We said from the beginning, no verification. When Biden repeated the 40 beheaded children, we said, that's not true. When they talked about, you know, burned bodies, that's not true. And the people who were killed also by shells and so on from the Israeli tanks and gunships. So this fabrication gains a life and attraction of its own and becomes the basis of policy and public perceptions. So that's how they try to destroy UNRWA. Now, name a single organization that has 30,000 angels as members, that none of them has made a mistake or belong to any forbidden organization. To me, if only 7 or 10 of thousands of people were implicated in something that is illegal or a crime or whatever, that's a very, very small percentage, lower than the national average of any country. And even that is not proven or demonstrated, because the names of all UNRWA people are vetted by Israel. You don't know that. They are presented to Israel. They are also vetted by the U.S. They are no secret. And Israel knew them and investigates each and every one of them. They just wanted to manufacture this in order to strike at UNRWA, and the preposterous response of the U.S. instantly cutting off the funds. That Congress says no more funding to UNRWA for the whole year, the year in which people are starving and they need UNRWA. And the minions in Europe, excuse my language, immediately did the same, started cutting off funding to UNRWA. Then it dawned on them that this is not just ridiculous, it's unbelievable, and it's extremely dangerous, and it will backfire. So they started backtracking one country after the other. You know, the latest was Japan restoring funding. The European Union didn't stop, and so on. But certain countries certainly mindlessly obey American directives, and America certainly mindlessly, not all of America, I'd say Congress, obeys Israeli directives. So it is time that this linkage stops, that people stop to think. If you are in a position of power and responsibility, you cannot take knee-jerk positions, you cannot react, you cannot act irresponsibly and jeopardize a whole region and probably the world in order to comply with Israeli lies and directives.
I want to look at another aspect of this, because there's been a lot of talk ever since October 7th. What do we do as the end game? What do we do in Gaza the day after the conflict ends? And reforming the Palestinian Authority, you know, there's talk of bringing in international forces, all of mm-hmm. this. And there are moves being made in the Palestinian Authority. And look, you've been active in this. You resigned from the executive committee as a way of putting pressure on them to renew the Palestinian Authority, to bring in new people. What is the status of all of that? Can it be saved?
Yeah. Look, of course, you know the saying that you drop a penny and you're looking for it where the light is, not where it fell. You drop the penny in the darkness and you can't find it, so let's look for it under the street lamp. That's exactly, this is, in many cases, it is gaslighting. What you're saying is that the problem is with the Palestinian Authority, the corruption, mismanagement. Palestinians say it's cooperation and coordination with the Israeli security. It's lack of human rights record. We can give you a whole list of things wrong. This is our issue. It's our problem. From the beginning, I have headed and established reform initiatives and institutions, anti-corruption institutions, and so on. A very active civil society is questioning and holding the authority and the political leadership responsible. This is a Palestinian issue. If anybody needs to be changed, it's the bloodthirsty fascist government in Israel coalition. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and others who are calling for nuking the Palestinians, who are literally killing and destroying and massacring the Palestinians and committing this genocide. These are the people who have to be changed. That's the problem. It's not the problem is whether it is we have a lily white, totally perfect Palestinian authority. And you change the Palestinian authority, you change it. What will you get? Are you going to get a more acquiescent authority? No. No, because whoever is elected or is appointed, and certainly must never be appointed, we need to have elections, huh? Will be living under Israeli threat, control, lack of freedom of movement, lack of control over the land or the resources. They don't have full control over the, they don't have any sovereignty. Even the resources, the land, the people, the population, everything is under Israeli control. Their money is under Israel. And the money is used as a leverage, as a means of putting pressure on the authority. That's not the issue. The issue is the occupation, the ongoing occupation and its impunity, the unholy alliance with Western colonial powers, leading us to this situation where you have unbridled violence, unaccountable genocide. This is it.
That is the real problem. And one gets the sense that there's still those Israelis, and this includes everybody that might succeed Netanyahu as prime minister, who somehow think that, yeah, we got to keep the occupation, but we got to, you know, solve the problem with the Palestinians. But that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. They look at their own internal realities in total isolation of the toxic nature of the occupation, of the war crimes they're committing. They think that they can live in a Tel Aviv bubble without being influenced by the killing and the cruelty of the settlers in the West Bank. An hour away from Tel Aviv, you have settlers on the rampage, carrying out pogroms, burning villages, destroying homes, killing people. That's okay, because that doesn't affect them. But that's what led to this schizophrenic approach to reality and to not dealing with the real causes. Okay, it's easy to say it's Netanyahu. Of course, Netanyahu has a long history of extreme right-wing, violent fascist tendencies. But he is allied. His coalition is made up of people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. And these are people who were designated as terrorists, even by Israeli standards. And Ben-Gvir is arming the settlers. He's telling them shoot to kill Palestinians and so on. Smotrich is the one who's confiscating the money and Palestinian money and who's calling also for killing all Palestinians. They're calling, there's no innocent Palestinian. Even the president of Israel said that, not just the Minister of Defense, so-called Defense Gallant. Everybody is implicit. Everybody is complicit, sorry. Everybody is implicated in this genocide. And it has had a rising curve. The moment all along, every single government built settlements, stole land, and committed the war crime of settlements by bringing in its citizens to settle in Palestine and on Palestinian land and depriving it. All along, they created an apartheid system. Palestinians have no rights whatsoever. Israelis and Israeli settlers have all the rights. And so on and so on. They built up to this situation where they feel perfectly free to advocate, you know, total genocide and using nuclear weapons. And even, I can't believe they are ordinary Israelis, but Israelis are standing up and speaking and celebrating the death and the carnage and the burning and the killing. Somebody says, you know, we want to have a clear view of the sea from Gaza. It's beautiful. Or somebody, even Jared Kushner said, we have to develop that land. Develop what? You're destroying an ancient culture. You're destroying total families and areas and so on. To build what? You weren't there. Your family wasn't there. You don't know what the history of Gaza is. Even though you're destroying the churches and the artifacts and the museums and all our archaeological sites in Gaza. It's, as I said, destroying the past and the present to prevent us, deprive us from having a future. So, in a way, this is something that is not going to work, because you keep making the same mistake, compounding the crime time and time, thinking that if you do more, if you commit more violence, if you demolish more homes, if you kill more Palestinians, you will solve the problem. No. This is how the problem started 76 years ago, and it's going to continue unless there is the courage to deal with the real causes, unless there is the courage to recognize. And this is the Israeli public, that the Palestinians deserve equal rights, that the Palestinians are the indigenous population in Palestine, that Israel was created at the expense of the Palestinians, and that when we gave them the opportunity to accept to live side by side, they rejected it, and they continued to build more settlements, steal more land and resources, and kill more Palestinians and demolish more homes. So the Israeli public has to wake up. They cannot say we have the most moral army in the world as they are slaughtering people and laughing and filming themselves and fetishizing even Palestinian women's clothes and stealing their jewelry and so on. And two, you cannot keep saying that we can demonize the Palestinians and dehumanize them and get away with it, because people are watching, people are learning what's happening, and you should see what's being done in your name.
There are Jewish voices that are standing up with the Palestinians calling for an end to this carnage. Do you have any hope left? Are you drawing anything out of this that says there will be a better day?
Yeah, there has to be a better day. I think this is the pits. This is the lowest of the low. I don't think the human reality can sink any lower. Yes, there are Jewish voices. They have been our allies for a long, long time. They have the courage to stand up to Israel and to defy Israel's claim that it speaks on behalf of all Jews. We know Jewish Voice for Peace. We know Not in My Name. We know others who started years ago, and they are very outspoken and very courageous, and they're being accused of all sorts of things. But of course, anybody who supports Palestinian rights and who holds Israel to account will be accused of everything, from anti-Semitism all the way down. So yes, that has to be acknowledged, certainly. But the Israeli government wants to speak on behalf of not just all Jewish Israelis, and it's not a monolithic public, of course, but of all Jews all over the world, which is not true, because, as they say, it's not in my name. You don't do that on my behalf. And I will not be responsible for what you are doing. I will not be held accountable. So, yeah, there is hope because of what we were talking about, because there is an awakening, because Israel can no longer literally get away with murder, because the public is holding their leaders accountable, because people like Biden, with his blind allegiance to Israel, is now being questioned and challenged and might lose elections. Because, as we said, the minorities and oppressed communities and indigenous peoples all over the world, they recognize the commonality. Palestine is not just a part of the global conversation on rights. It is the acid test of your commitment to human rights and a global rule of law and humanity as a whole. And the courage to stand up and challenge and speak out is emerging. Before, people used to get intimidated. Before, people lost their jobs. Before, you know, now there is enough solidarity so that people have the courage to defy and to stand up and to disrupt, as is happening in the elections in the US. So yes, I have hope, because any system that relies for its continuity on the ignorance of its people or others will not last long, because ignorance is a transient state. People have access to knowledge and to the truth. And that is our greatest ally. The moral fiber, the sense of responsibility of generations now, and of minorities and oppressed people, and academics as well. And of course, the fact that once you know the truth, you have to act on the basis of that truth if you want to have a real solution. So maybe not in my lifetime, of course, I used to think, we will have a Palestinian state, we will have freedom. And I promised this to my daughters when we went to negotiations, as you remember. No, that's not going to happen. I had to take that back. Now I think it will take a bit longer, but I think there is really a sea change. And the existing fault lines in the West and in the North and the South and East and West, these are now becoming very obvious, very clear. And that these have to have serious changes in relationships, in economic and human and legal relationships all over the world. And I think that's where I find hope for Palestine.
Hanan Ashrawi, I want to thank you for being with us. Really, an informative talk. It is always good to see you, one of the most long-standing politicians, activists, and scholars. Somebody in defense of Palestinian culture. So much more than just the politics, Hanan Ashrawi. Yeah. And thank you for that.
Thank you, Jim. And thank you for your own courage and the lucidity of your own voice and moral fiber. Thank you.
And thank you for being with us. Be sure to like and follow The Brief Podcast here on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And explore some of our other episodes as we discuss international affairs. For now, I'm Jim Clancy.